This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry, books, writing, and the future of publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I'm doing something a little unusual, interviewing three people at the same time, so we can expect it to be a little more confusing than normal interviews. I'm interested in a place called, or a thing called, Penn Sound, which is an audio collection of principally of poets at the University of Pennsylvania. And the three people that I'm talking to today are Al Filreis and Charles Bernstein, who are the co-directors, and Mike Hennessy, who's the editor of the archive. So welcome to you all. Thank you for doing this. And I'm assuming a lot of, you know, I know a lot of people know about Penn Sound, but maybe either Al or Charles could talk a little bit about the genesis of the project and what it is you set out to do.
Go ahead, Charles.
Okay. Well, Penn Sound is the largest archive of poetry recordings available on the web. Al and I started it 10 years ago at the University of Pennsylvania. We have both been doing a great deal of web-related poetry work and sites, but at that time, with the advent of streaming and compressed audio files, which we could summarize here by just saying MP3s, we thought we could finally make the material available that we had been collecting. And so we got started, and we had several principles, one of which is key, which was to make all of the audio recordings available free for non-commercial educational use, and also downloadable, and also to make entire recordings, everything that we had available, not selecting and excerpting, and also to segment the readings, just as you would with any live concert, so that each individual poem got its own file. So this is both a massive distribution project that makes available thousands of poems by hundreds of poets, but also a preservation project, probably in the end the largest preservation project of English language poetry that exists, because as we made it available, we also preserved it in these MP3 files.
So Al, can you say, at you know, when you first started, did you have any idea of how many poems and poets you might end up collecting?
Well, actually, David, I think we did. That was what's so crazy about our having decided to do the project. I think we knew what was going to happen. We didn't quite know how successful we'd be, but we knew we had access to really thousands of poems, if you break up the readings, hundreds of readings already. Things that Charles had recorded himself and collected otherwise in his journey, and most recently then at Buffalo, hosting and being part of a series for years, and then really having all of his contacts in the poetry world, people who are sitting on cassettes, excuse me, and reel-to-reels and so forth. And then at the University of Pennsylvania at the Kelly Writers House, which was founded in 1995 and maybe starting in 1997, began to record everything. We knew we had lots. So we weren't worried. We had no illusions about scope. We knew this was going to be big. What we didn't anticipate was how, and my colleagues might disagree with this, but how relatively easy the concept was. We wanted to make it easy so we could get the job done. We didn't want to be delayed by setting up standards that would be impossible to meet, really. So the thing is structured very simply. It's a website, and underneath or behind that website is a very well-organized media server full of mostly audio and some video. So, and the website is as simple as it could possibly be, or almost as simple. And so it's the real work has been making sure that the website is constantly up to date and processing the mounds and mounds of material that still have to be has to be digitized and then segmented.
Well, and that raises that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you about the process of digitizing. You mentioned reel to reel and cassette. I presume much of what you got or have gotten over time came from those earlier formats. So how many cassettes and how many reel-to-reel tapes have you, you know, came to you or did you have, and how many have you digitized so far, and therefore how many are left to do?
Well, Mike, you want to take a stab at that?
It would have to be thousands of cassette tapes. Reel-to-reels are a slightly rare commodity, but we still, on occasion, will get certain archives or from poets a healthy collection of 20 or 30 of them at a stretch. But the cassettes being a sort of a democratic, easily accessible technology, and I think that's a key part of what made these communities able to document themselves in a very grassroots way without institutional support decades and decades ago, was that you could go to Kmart and buy a relatively inexpensive consumer-grade tape player and some compact cassettes, and you could be your own audio archivist. So as the project has grown, I have been in Charles's office and seen the massively impressive wall of cassette tapes. I mean, Charles, your collection is probably 2,000 or 3,000 cassettes in and of itself, most of which are ones that you made yourself. And many of our friends in the poetry community, once they got wind of Penn Sound, would then say, oh, by the way, I've got a box of 100 tapes in my garage not doing anything. Would you like to process them? So it's over the past 10 years, probably well over several thousand cassette tapes alone.
Do you have a lot more to do? I mean, it sounds like you would, but...
I should make two distinctions, one of which is, and I think Al emphasized this in terms of the series that we have curated and taped ourselves at the University of Pennsylvania, at Buffalo, and in New York, that I was involved in. That's a very important part of the collection, and that's really what I think is an interesting point of that cassette, which I haven't really heard made quite that way, but he's making arguments for cassette, David, that you will know about in terms of the whole media revolution and the small press, which obviously you've been so deeply involved in. And it's interesting to see the relationship between Mimeo and Xerox and cassette in terms of the core aspect of our collection, which I would say is the post-75 or maybe even post-sure when cassette comes in. Probably remember that better than me right this second. We also have a historical component, which has been fundamental. So we have collected a huge amount of the modernist and earlier period recordings, including the full collection of Town, Yates, Sign, Williams, a great deal of Wallace Stevens, and with the permission of the estates to make available. Those particular recordings came to us in various forms. Sometimes they were on record, sometimes they were reel-to-reel. So there are these two distinct parts, but the historical part is one of the big things that people come to for our collection. As to what's left, the material that we came in with when we started 10 years ago is almost finished. A lot of people have given us stuff, as Mike has mentioned and Al, over the time, and we continue to get stuff, but a lot of the segmenting still remains to be done, and there's new material coming in all the time. And, of course, now, potentially, new recordings made constantly. And those can come into us in digital form, which are easier for us to process. People making recordings right now, of course, make them and can even send them to us in MP3. So an important part of Penn Sound is that it's a collective. There's a lot of different groups that are working with us and a lot of entities and a lot of series. If you go to the series page, you'll see large numbers of the recordings that were done by organizations and groups. And those people work with us, sometimes making the material available in our format, sometimes working with us to convert them so that we convert them to our format. But they're cooperative. They control the pages. They've curated their series, and they make them available to us because we're really the best way for someone with an audio collection to make it accessible.
And it is an incredible collection. I mean, I think the reason I didn't say that at the outset, but one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you was that it's just so profoundly amazing to see all of these people or well, actually to hear all of these people, you know, if you have any interest whatsoever in poetry, for any almost any time imaginable in the 20th century, you can find people that you're interested in, maybe that you never heard read while they were alive, and maybe people that you did hear, but you know, the moment was fleeting. It might have been 30, 40, 25 years ago. It's an incredible resource and really impressive. I noticed.
Thank you, David. It's very nice to hear that.
Well, I
believe me, it's very nice to hear that. And I just want to reiterate, I mean, we'll accept that praise. The three of us will gladly accept that praise. But I want to push back a little bit and pick up what Charles just said. It really is a collective enterprise. So once we set things out, we set some standards, we made it clear that we were, that Penn Sound was a place to come to for this material, then stuff, our phones started ringing and our emails started humming as people began to realize, well, this has a certain amount of credence. Why don't I go to the basement and pick out my box of cassettes that I've been lovingly caring for and hoping for the day when someone else could set up an enterprise that would digitize it, make it available. So I would say, and Charles and Mike can revise this if it's not right, but I'd say once a month we get, or maybe once every 6 weeks, we'll get an email from someone we know, either well or somewhat, from the poetry community who says, you know, I'm ready to send you these boxes of dozens of tapes. I'm ready to have my stuff put up there. And that's,
you know, another aspect.
We gathered this momentum, and then the rest, you know, we're doing the work, but really the your praise was for the depth of the thing, and the depth of the thing comes from a community coming together and realizing there's not a lot of money to be made. There's no money to be made in this, so we might as well work together for a non-profit, free, accessible, no password, no fees, you know, just a completely open site. We might as well just go open.
Well, no, I think that's actually the secret, or maybe not the secret, but the obvious characteristic that makes it so powerful, and that is that it is available to anybody. It's not a, you know, you can go online sometimes researching, let's say, some literary subject, and you'll come to a library which has a holding, and you can look at what they have, but you can't see the actual thing. And it's really frustrating, you know, there's all this great stuff locked up in archives that people don't have access to unless they physically go to that archive. And what you've been able to do here is make it public in this, you know, and that's really, I think that's important. I think, as you said,
I would emphasize on this point, which is so fundamental, that we, Al and I, when we started, and Mike was just absolutely kindred spirit when we met him a few years later, are committed to this idea of no paywalls and to have the material that we are able to assemble through our work at a university available to anyone. You don't have to have a card. And it's curious that this exists also in contrast, you know, to issues around music and other kinds of websites. Where there's, you know, different kinds of issues around payment, but also many institutions have recordings that sometimes they work with us and make them available, but they're unable or unwilling to make them available on their own in the way that we are or reluctant to, as well as institutions in Europe. So we see what you just described as a model for what the web can be, as an exchange and an open exchange. Poets, because of the nature of the poetry community that Al described, are actually committed to this polis, this common place that we have. And, of course, we do a service even to the estates as well as the contemporary poets by preserving their material without cost to them. They, in turn, make that material available. So it's a win-win situation for everyone.
Right. And I think clearly...
That's actually,
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, that's been a beautiful part of witnessing the evolution of the site from sort of the inside and the outside, as well as the phenomenon that Al was describing about people in the community who then hit a sort of a watershed moment and decide that they want to be part of this process. But that is also something that happened with who we featured on the site, who we were able to get permission, because all of our recordings are permissioned by the poets themselves or by the estate. And in the beginning, it was just because it was a simple fact of the matter, the time that we had to devote to these resources. But some people were maybe reluctant, and some people's reluctance quickly faded away. I remember it was a big moment for us when we got permission to use John Ashbery's recordings. And I think that Ashbery's presence on the site was a vote of confidence for a lot of other people who then subsequently gave us permission as well.
Well, actually, I did. That's
Ashbery, interesting to note that David Carmani, who works with John as his partner, so enthusiastic about it that he would give me shopping bags of every possible recorded archive that you have. So there's almost nothing comparable to what we have of Ashbery, because they just gave us everything and gave us permission to put everything up. You would never be able to go through that if it was in the library, if in fact any, if there was any recording data, any recording archive as big as there is of John Ashbery. So it was a floodgate, and it was a model for what we wanted. We don't edit and put up, you know, the best things or most important things. We put up everything.
Well, it is, one question I had for you in connection with that is, because you have to permission, what happens if you get something and you can't find, I mean, I know there are some poets, some writers whose literary executorship is sometimes not clear, or where the literary executor may not be alive anymore, and who knows what's happening, you know, who's in charge, who owns the rights, or who has the ability to give you permission. Have you run into that with any of, I mean, some of the poets I would imagine somewhat fugitive too, and what do you do then?
David, this is Al. This is an area that we could, all the three of us could talk about for hours. This is such an interesting topic. I'll just throw out something and then my colleagues can add to it. You've touched upon what is obviously a gray area. It's a gray area in practical procedure. It's a gray area in legal terms. I mean, really. And then, so those are actual gray areas, and then you get the gray area of a lot of people making claims that they don't have a right to claim. A lot of people misunderstand that if a publisher publishes the text of a poet, the publisher, some people in the publishing house might think they have rights to audio pertaining to those same poems, but that's not true. And so one has to navigate a whole thicket of people making claims that they don't quite understand they shouldn't be making. So add to that the complication that you referred to, which is that some of the estates themselves are not clear. Let's say you have the estate of a poet who's been dead for 30 years. The family more or less is out of the business of regular day-to-day traffic, but they want to be notified about special circumstances. Well, we generally have relationships with the poet's children or siblings or partners, and we generally have personal relationships. And yet that family has decided to cede most of the responsibility for permission giving to a publisher or a third party. And so we typically go to the family, and then we have to triangulate. So sometimes this is tricky. And in the case of Wallace Stevens, I think it took us about 3 years to get it done. And we waited. Now, we are very, very scrupulous. I take my lead here from Charles, who's very, very, very scrupulous. We must get permission. We're not going to do anything without permission, and therefore it takes a while. But, you know, the three of us are in this for the long run, so we don't mind waiting.
Well, that's a good answer. And I think, well, is there anyone that you're currently waiting for that you feel strongly about, that, you know, it's really as important as, say, Wallace Stevens, or, you know, getting John Ashbery or something like that? Is there anybody out there that you really are just really working hard on or waiting for at this point, or can you not? Do you feel uncomfortable talking about that? That's okay.
I would say that one thing is that I didn't mention when I gave the period. The period you're also very interested in. We do have a lot of stuff from the 50s and 60s, Creeley and Olson, along with Ashbery. By and large, there are very few of the poets or the poets' families that don't want to have this material available. It's quite rare, and especially the older you get, historically, the more it's a preservation issue, which we're providing a solution for. There is an occasional person, and I won't mention one person I have in mind, it's very rare, who just doesn't, you know, even though the person is fantastic performer, doesn't want to have their material available. So I keep writing to that person every couple of years saying, have you changed your mind? I think as far as we focus on that in terms of the modernists and the new American poetry generation, and I don't think that there's anything huge that we're waiting for. With something like Basil Bunting was very important to me, and Hugh McDermott, because their recordings are, of course, so important to the history of the sound. That those albums gave a good description of what it was like. We had to work long and hard to get those permissions from all the parties concerned, who are now very happy. So that occurred a number of years ago, but that took several years in that case. So I'm not sure that I would want to say anything that's extant. Now we have the opposite issue now, is that there are many younger people who'd like to be on the site, and we're very curated, and we just don't have the personnel or the possibility to include everything. And we do emphasize a particular aesthetic more in the tradition of the radical modernists and new American poets, and sort of more toward innovative poets. But we have a strong historical component, so that we will include a range of different things because they meet a historical need that we feel for the site.
Let me throw out two examples of this, so we can be specific in these two cases. These are two examples of poets whom for whom we don't have permission yet. One of them is Conrad Aiken, and the other is Edward Dahlberg. Let me just tell you about those two. So I found a bunch of Aiken recordings in various archives. Aiken is just behind the first American modernist generation. So he's an old poet. He wouldn't be a poet who's, to be perfectly frank, whose poems, were they being written today, would be of that much interest to us. But he is historically pretty significant. And there's no Aiken, as far as I know, there's no Aiken recordings available, and he's more or less forgotten. But I do have my hands on some of these recordings, and I'm in the process of trying to figure out who are the Aiken heirs. And once I reach them, there isn't any doubt in my mind. I'm 98% sure, based on what Charles was saying before, they're going to be delighted. Nobody's asked for anything in years. And they're going to be delighted. They've long ago given up that they're on making money off of the Aiken legacy, I'm sure. There's probably a little royalty coming in if they have anything in copyright. But beyond that, they're going to be very, very happy. Dahlberg is an interesting character. He's not much of a poet, but he was very close. As an older man, he sort of had his heyday in the 1930s. But as an older guy in the 50s and early 60s, he was weirdly in Chicago very supportive of the Young Turks, beat-affiliated poets. Dahlberg was himself a very persnickety, difficult character. But I have a feeling the Dahlberg family has long ago given up on making Dahlberg stuff available, and I have a feeling that they're going to be very happy when we approach them. And if anybody from the Aiken or Dahlberg families is listening to this podcast, I hope they'll get in touch with us. But those are great examples, and both of those will go into our site. And it's very possible, and I don't think we're bragging here, and maybe Mike and Charles can comment on this phenomenon, but when Penn Sound puts out a kind of full, you know, a collected audio collection of a poet, even a major poet, suddenly there's a lot of interest in the sound, in the quality of the sound of the poet. Scholars, young scholars start working on it, people start listening, and we notice a little bit more traffic out there on Facebook and Twitter, and just in general, people are talking a little more. It's a smallish world, and we can have an impact. So if Aiken and Dahlberg go on the site, Aiken and Dahlberg are that much more in circulation.
Well, and I think...
And Dahlberg, an absolutely fantastic writer. Wonderful. It would be thrilling to have his stuff. I didn't really realize until hearing how so this, that we had Dahlberg recording. So
yeah, we have actually a bunch of Dahlberg recordings. Yeah. Yeah.
No, I think that actually would be very important. I want to compliment you and call out your recent posting of Basil Bunting work, because, I mean, I have a personal interest in his writing, but also because I think for people who have not listened to him, you have to hear his voice before you really can understand the poetry. If you read the book without hearing it, you're losing part of the... a key element of the writing, and so Basil's work is just incredibly one incredibly important, and that having his voice, I think, available is really great. And I think you have that's a Jonathan.
So that particular page is edited by a man named Richard Swig, and this is another thing that's worth acknowledging, Al, and Mike said it implicitly. Sometimes you have scholars edit pages. They're also the William Carlos Williams was edited by Swig, as well as the Oppen. Those are amazing pages, which are comprehensive of all the available recordings, which Swig has found over many, many years. Now, Richard, in the case of the Bunting, there was the permission issue because the publisher in England, even though he's obviously not a best-selling author, they had put out a DVD and a DVD now,
right,
of him reading class, and they were selling that. So that, you know, that to me is, you know, I bow to that. If you actually have something in commercial circulation, which would be like 0.1% of all material, then I can understand. But even so, they came through and let us have selections from Brick Flats, from a different reading, actually, than the one that they have. And theirs was a DVD as well, but with the picture of Bunty reading. But Swig came up with many, many other things, lectures, and also all these readings that Bunting did of other poets. So it's an extraordinary breadth of stuff, which is quite different than just the Blake Flats reading, which is what was available commercially.
Right, and of course it is true that Blood Axe, the publisher in England, who does his books with, as you said, with does have a DVD, but it's not widely, I mean, you can buy it on Amazon, which I've done.
Right,
but
that's what we would argue with Tara. The number of people who are going to get it, if you just want to hear about it, even the people right now, that we, David and I, are encouraging you, just listen to a second chest. It's mind-blowing to hear him read. It's just going to be a fraction of the people who actually get a hold of that thing. But still, that's a publisher who has something that's in print. Very rare for us, so we have to respect their interests and work with them and, you know, work and explain, as Al said, which to me, and you were saying the same thing, there's no question, that having that material on Pen Pen would only increase the interest in Basil Bunting. So you don't want to, destroy the potential new people who will come in because of the proprietariness of it. But in poetry, people tend to be very good about these issues, unlike in other areas where the proprietary interests reign. I would say that if we didn't start Pen Sound when we did, though, you would see lots of entirely commercial accumulators gobble up all these things as MP3s and resell them at $1 per file and lock up the copyrights in a way that you, instead of having millions of people listen through Pen Sound, you'd have hundreds of people listening that way. So that I think one of the great things that Pen Sound did was to avoid the unnecessary commercialization and privatization of this material, which would have benefited the poets not at all. Any individual poet would get no income from it, but it would prevent people from having access, and especially quick access, which is so great about Pen Sound. You just hear the name, you can immediately go online and hear the poet. For us, this increases the interest in these great poets enormously. Making it difficult to get the material is killing for poetry in the current environment.
Right. No, I think overall, it's clear, easy to say, and I can't imagine that any poet would object to this, that it's much more important to be read in this environment than it is to be paid. So, it's what I've called, or I think I'm sure other people call, it's an attention economy, not a money economy. And
you say that is involved with selling books too, which I appreciate.
Well, it is, yeah. And I think that, but what you, because this is a non-commercial venue, I think you have to, I think it's a good exemplar for even people who are in commercial publishing to see that, as what you just said was very important. I think that when you put a poet's work up in audio form on your site, interest in the poet increases. So I think, you know, that might be interesting for people who are thinking in terms of marketing physical books or printed books or ebooks or whatever it might be, that availability and the easy availability to find out about someone and their work makes it more likely you would be interested in them, and that of course would translate whether theoretically or directly into book sales, but certainly into more awareness of that writer's work, which, you know, clearly for poetry matters more than, I mean, awareness matters to all writers in all forms, but poets don't make any money, so awareness is really the stock in trade.
Absolutely.
And I think the one of the things I've found is that, and this is not to be a criticism, but it's really easy to spend a lot of time on your site, and that can sometimes be detrimental to getting other work done, because you end up listening to lots of really interesting poets reading, and it is a linear experience. You know, unlike music, and I know this is obvious, but listen to music as a background thing. So the MP3 you can be listening to music while you're doing something else, but it's hard to listen to a poet and do something else. You need to pay attention and hear the words. So if there's any criticism of Penn Sound, it's that you suck time out of our lives because we can't help but listen to what you've put up there.
Actually, and I'm not making a joke here, we have some quite contemporary poets who really don't want you to concentrate. They'd rather you throw this thing on your iPod and listen to them as a kind of ambient background noise. I'm serious.
We have some poets
who are very serious about not wanting you to concentrate on their sounds.
Well, maybe we should, you know, there's a theme there. Maybe you could give them their own section.
Go to the Tom Lynn page, who is the proponent of ambient poetry, and you'll see what that means.
All right, well, that's something new for me.
Actually, even Venerable Old John Ashbery has talked about that in interviews, where he talks, and Ashbery is a unique sort of performer of his own poetry, but I've read in interviews where he likened to poetry reading to something like Satie's furniture music, and he particularly likes that venue, which I guess translates to the recorded poem as well, as something that the listener can tune in and tune out of at their leisure, rather than have to have this singular focused experience of the poet's language.
What's so interesting about Ashbery, Mike, is that that's true for himself as he reads himself, but it's not true for any of the rest of us who are sitting there trying to figure out what the hell is going on.
That's great. Well, listen, I know we've reached the point where I know Charles has to leave, so I think we should probably close there. And just, I really want to thank you for spending the time and talking about Penn Sound. I want to mention to those who are listening that to find the site, it's writing.upenn.edu/PennSound. But if you don't want to memorize that, just go to Google, look up Penn Sound, and click. You'll be there. And it's a great site. I really recommend to everybody to go there and spend a little time and see what's there and kind of make it a habitual landing place for your web browsing. So thanks, Al Filreis, Charles Bernstein, Mike Hennessy, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.